Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, March 13th, 2004. This is a poetry reading by Greg Fried, session number FRG 2004-02.
Good evening. Thank you for coming. The first poem is called, appropriately enough, Introduction. It has taken me all these years to write these lines. For you see, first I had to learn the language. Not a simple thing. It took me a long time just to get the rudiments down. And I needed more than a passing familiarity. I needed intimacy so that my very dreams took place in colorful, rhythmic English. Then I had to learn to write the language. And although I thought I had it mastered as a child, it seems that only lately do my script and my thoughts come to resemble each other. Then I had to know joy, giving the perfect gift, hitting a home run, coasting down a hill, Christmas morning kind of joy. Then I had to know pain, from failure, from loss, from association. There were decades of falling in love, parenting, teaching, learning, dark hours of horror, guilt, sympathy, bright windows of discovery, mirth, and grace. So these words bear doubt and pride, witness to folly and sacrifice, betray secrets and innocence. These lines are as sturdy and as frail as I, the man who wrote them. There's a certain amount of arrogance that goes into a public reading of one's own poetry. The idea that what I have written is meaningful or entertaining or profound sometimes makes me cringe, but at other times it makes me feel like a prophet. I believe that we are all poets because all language is metaphor. I may be different from some of you in that I've developed the practice of writing down things as a form of celebration, prayer, memorial, or amusement. So despite my arrogance, I humbly offer myself in these poems tonight. Fish. I'd like to fashion a fish of wood, but I lack the time, talent, and tools. So I'll fashion a fish of words, a trout. Working the shadows of a derelict bridge on an autumn afternoon, the river, a model of persistence, carrying subsistence in a great smooth arc, is disturbed by the pilings and planking of the failed bridge. It's a cutthroat. Its shiny green back writhing slowly, a small imitation of the river, facing upstream, the mecca for its kind. My fish keeps to the shadow, lest the sunlight play among the bright spots that spangle its sides. Its tail, a dotted flag in the fluid breeze, never rests. The expression of dispassion betrays nothing. Neither cold nor fear, longing or loneliness. The eye is dark, unblinking, and reflective of the completeness of the universe that is the river. Into the sun my fish flashes, bright red of gill and gold of flank, leaving the shadow to catch and release a bit of flotsam, then folds itself back into the shade, slick. Life on Earth. I wanted to write this poem today, but I got a late start. After dreaming that my father did this witless thing, and I rebuked him for it. Such a dream is not restful. So I languished in that place that is neither sleep nor sentience, until the phone roused me to a task. As it does, One event led into the next in the pattern of life on Earth, and I found myself in one non-writing scene after another, enjoying a visit with my son, commiserating over a problem with my daughter, putting on the small variety show that lends to the credits of my life. Then, while watching the sky perform the magic of breathing clouds in and out of existence, I remembered this poem. On paper. I'm hoping to get a few good words down on paper. It's not good, this word constipation. Words can build up in a person and become a sort of poison. At first, the victim becomes introspective, and then melancholy, and then socially awkward, unable to converse except in banalities. At length, it is akin to drowning, as words fill up in the lungs, slowly choking the aspiring writer in pools of his own words. A ghastly terminus, all for the want of a few well-turned sentences. Kidney stone. I've had a broken heart and a kidney stone, and although the kidney stone hurt worse, it passed. In dreams. Often in dreams I can play the guitar with precision and efficiency, with economy and style, with a satisfying slide. And although I experience the joy, I never sense the impossibility. This, I believe, is the higher purpose of dreams, to know what the heart sounds like, to feel the nap of the soul, to see the possibility. The palm of my right hand caresses the mahogany neck, warm and familiar. My fingers dance on the ebony, fret to fret. As my left hand squeezes words out of this pencil, so it sets the steel strings to quiver over the pickups. Buffalo. I'm the only human in a 10-mile radius. Yellowstone's east entrance road is 10 feet below me. I take in pristine 5-degree air and leave behind partially burned petroleum. The sky is blue. It's the blue of a tourist postcard, clearer and bluer than it could be in ordinary life. This is anything but ordinary. The crystalline air is still until I disturb it, and were it not for me and my machine, there would be bright silence. The vast frozen lake to my right looks like a sugar spill of cosmic proportion. The lake viewed in front of me holds 10,000 flock trees. Like an astronaut, I've got no business being here, certainly not in comfort. I'm in a moment that continues all my life, a present that makes me thank God for memory. I round a bend to the east and skid to a stop. 20 yards in front of me and above, a buffalo stands in profile on the side hill. Covered with hoar frost and eclipsing the sun, he is a giant hairy fumarole with steam proceeding in abundance. The rays of the sun burst forth from behind the beast and diffuse into the extraordinary blue, robbing me of my breath. I have the presence of mind to reach for my camera and the good sense to stop, for this is a poem, not a picture. Mm-hmm. Dreams. The work done in dreams goes uncompensated. It's charity care, pro bono work. That does not diminish the effort, but it is a judgment about the accomplishment. For I've toiled these many years in the fields of sleep, and my back hurts and my brow is furrowed. But I still can't make a dream of substance, and I've yet to become wise or virtuous. This said, I'll be back on the job tonight, mixing up lust and fear, pride and shame, friends and enemies. As I mentioned, I've had some kidney stones. During my most recent stone, I wrote this piece. My turn. The bright, awful pain, like the pain that I have inflicted on so many, time and again, casually, like cleaning a fish that still lives, taking out a fillet by slicing along the spine and then back up just under the skin. The cruel surgeon laughs at a joke and then curses the flies attracted to the gore. Hitler's car. I didn't know the word genocide. I was only 9 or 10. I didn't know any Jews or homosexuals. But my mom said our cleaning lady was a gypsy. I'd never seen a dead body, but I knew the difference between a Panzer and a Sherman, a Mustang and a Messerschmitt. I recognized the uniform of the Luftwaffe and the SS, the Iron Cross and the swastika and that mustache. So it was with excitement that I got into his car. The glass was an inch thick. I could barely open the doors. They were armor-plated. I was told that the thing weighed 8 tons. In the back where he sat, I sat, on black leather seats. It didn't smell like death. It smelled like a museum. The huge engine roared, and we circled the park. I peered out of the unfamiliar limousine into the familiar park, perhaps as he had done, going through the Brandenburg Gate to the Reichstag. I don't know who his driver was. Mine was my neighbor, the millionaire who bought his car 20 years after the Battle of the Bulge, after the fall of Berlin, after the bunker. I'd never heard the words labor and camp used together before. But 20 years after the liberation of Mauthausen, I'm riding in his car past my home. 50 years after the liberation of Mauthausen, I'm standing within its stone walls on a sunny day in the Danube Valley. I'm squinting through the tears. I'm gulping for air. There's ghosts everywhere, the quarry, the barracks, the ovens. It doesn't smell like death. It smells like a summer afternoon. Son, 22, marries. Some events pass by wordlessly, like watching a great ship glide silently out of the harbor, heavy laden with the wealth and treasures of this land and bound for the colonies. The next piece I included because I wrote it at Stehekin a number of years ago while Susie and I were camped at Purple Point Campground. I think most of you know that point. It's called Melt. A glacier, about the size of my hometown, retreats stoically above the headwaters of the Stehekin River. Passivity among such glaciers makes their runoff green, jade water from the jaded ice mass. There is no such languor once the water leaves its home of these many millennia, for it races post-haste, accelerating towards the center of the earth. Trickle to rivulet, to alpine creek, creek to cascade, to the river. This is where I come in, the ephemeral observer. I sit along the vast lake, that repository of fantastic gem-like water, the memory of its long coldness still fresh, as the wind forms it into waves and herds them in my direction. Of me, nothing is required. Water break. Spring. To walk in the perfect light of a spring evening with a head full of pleasantly mingling sights, sounds, and smells, that is life in full. Not one thing is less than fascinating. The most mundane object, a candy wrapper or an aluminum roof vent, is a vision of loveliness in this life. My very thoughts take wing and are both sweet and substantial while I'm breathing this perfume. I can't remember discomfort or misfortune. They are words now, nothing more. My feet enjoy their task as much as my heart, and my heart as much as my brain. This is grace. This is love. This is spring. Solace. I am not alone sitting here on a boulder beside this clear mountain lake with its still black mirrored surface broken here and there by hungry brook trout. I am not alone among the trees of countless sizes and shapes, candles of new growth brightening their greens when lit by the rising sun. I am not alone on this gracious morning of calm, cool air, the rare cloud not sure what to do with such a vast blue sky. I am not alone, for you are with me. This is a big one. The universe. Over a lunch of peanut butter and instant soup, I read an article in the National Geographic. It was titled, "The Universe Unveiled." Is this an ambitious journalistic endeavor or what? I chewed and slurped my way through dazzling photos of deft discussions about the nature of matter, the size of the cosmos, and the flexibility of time and space. I was introduced to scientists who are credited with special knowledge of the extremely large, the very small, and the unusually baffling. Was there a beginning? Will there be an end? Are there different kinds of infinity? Where is all that dark matter hiding? Then a woman from Chantal Cookware called. This was no accident, for my wife had called them to request a part for our tea kettle. She said I could get a new lid sealing O-ring for $4. Did I want to do that? I said I had carbon atoms in me from the death of a star billions of years ago, and that I'm one of 6 billion people on a planet orbiting one of 100 billion stars in our galaxy, and that our galaxy is one of 100 billion galaxies in the known universe. Well, of course I want the O-ring, because as it is now, my kettle doesn't whistle when the water boils. It seems impossible to me, but there might be some among you who don't know what a Stratocaster is. A Stratocaster is a solid body electric guitar made by Fender. It's the classic rock guitar favored by Jeff Beck, Jimi Hendrix, Eric Clapton, etc., etc. This is called Stratocaster. I know your voice better than my mother's. Perhaps you are my mother, not that sad woman with the wavy brown hair. Talk to me. Tell me how I feel, and have felt, and will feel. Tell me a story. Tell me the story, the one you always tell, the one that is never the same. Make it sing, make it sting, bite and slide, clean and pure, distort and blur. What do I know of hate? Where have I ever been? Who did I ever cheat that doesn't sound like you? Whisper her name to me. Promise you'll stay. Take another shot at me and leave me to wonder in the space between notes. The woods on a snowy evening. Fir forest, graceful and deep, choirs of trees swaying slightly in their stoles of snow. I labor by one trunk after another. My pack and I are blue in a world of white and black. My feet are 2 meters long today, an adaptation that allows me to be here in the woods on a snowy evening. Only my face is not covered with nylon, and the wind makes the snow sting as it strikes my cheeks. The rest of me is a snare drum, counting the chaotic rhythm of snowflakes. The meadows and the lakes are the same, for all I know, as light, which appears to come from beneath me, wanes. You can't be more alone or more susceptible to joy and sorrow than in this cold, sleeping place of monotonous beauty. Most people want this window on eternity, but they don't know it. So they haven't bothered to come here to see this terrible and wonderful sight. Here there is no blame, no guilt, no shame. There are no bosses, no wins, no losses. There is only snow and trees. Only snow and trees. Waiting room. My mind is the small waiting room where I'm spending my life. I know that I will be called, I just don't know when. I read the magazines, look at the pictures, pace a little, look out the windows. Although I know it is useless, I watch the clock. In fact, I watch the clock a lot. There may be one person here who doesn't know that I spent many years as an emergency physician, which is presupposed by the next poem. Work. I work between the insubstantial walls of health, where a conveyor belt of nurses carries a roster of complainants past my judgments. The lame, the insane, the abuser, the abused, the saint, the confused. All are given their chances to challenge my senses, humble my intellect, and try my heart. I portion to each from my tiny purse of wisdom and from my great storehouse of information. I might still have some injustice spattered on me as I move on to view impatience, which infects me, so that I fail to see nobility, but hurry past, tripping over decrepitude. They are me, of course, only under different circumstances and wearing different lives. And I am them in all my maladies and mortality. Wood carving. My own attempts at it were rude and unaccomplished. like the arrow I fashioned as a Boy Scout, a cottonwood stick that retained its shape and character throughout. It never became flint, sinew, willow, and feather. Or the small totem pole in my backyard, a raven and the sun that resemble a flat relief of a raven and the sun, but are lacking in spirit and medicine. Tillman Reimenschneider, now that guy could reanimate wood. After 500 years, the misery of a mother holding her executed son radiates out of the limewood, and I feel sick, sad, and guilty. St. Peter is tired from being both foolish and wise. The beardless face of St. John convinces me that he does know how the world ends, although motionless, his cloak flags in the breeze. The carved altarpiece in Rotenburg towers over the worshiper in majesty and in silence. It holds a crystal said to bear a drop of the blood of the Christ. Blood. So what? We can all make blood. '12:01. I have to write a poem in the first minute of this new day, to claim it in my name, to memorialize it for the future, for it will be the best day of someone's life, just as surely as it will be the worst day of someone else's. But from where I sit, it is a day unblemished, with no deception and much potential, a day of signs and portent, a day when predictions will come true and important people will be born. By the closing bell, more than one person will realize that this was a day to remember. And I will have been the first to write a poem about it. Batting cage. I tried to get my weight moving forward into the swing as I met the pitch with level shoulders. I know that I beamed inwardly as the line drive stretched the netting in what would be left center. I paid for 16 nearly perfect pitches from a machine. This machine made me feel 30 years younger, a dollar well spent. Hard work. Poetry is hard work. I stand on the beach at the point where the waves are spent and puzzle with the sea. The sea near the horizon is the color and texture of slate cloven off a Welsh mountainside. But it is the color and texture of New Zealand jade as it approaches me. And it is not easy to make something of that difference. The waves produce a head of white foam, both vivid and ethereal, as they break before the beach. Does this froth come from the ocean or from the air? And upon its equally sudden disappearance, to which does it return? Well, through hard work, it goes into these lines. The sand on which I work, alternately the floor of the ocean and the edge of the land, are suspended in the wave, and then dashed upon the shore where they settle out of the retreating water so as to make iridescent patterns in gold, bronze, and steel. Such beauty lasts no longer than a reading of this line before it is reinvented. The waves themselves demand my attention. They are the epitome of well-ordered chaos, irregular periodicity and amplitude, with a persistence beyond reckoning. But I need to come up with one word to describe them. Faithful. Thankfully, the sun, mostly veiled, is behind me, so I don't have to treat it with words. I'm too tired right now. This is hard work. (Clears throat) safety. A safe poem would be one in which no people are named, and without even veiled references to Mr. Bull in China Shop or Ms. I Told You So. A safe poem would lack crudeness and therefore exclude flatulence and boogers. Politics would be a taboo. Religion, a definite no-no. The usual mortality-death tension would have to be skipped. Nostalgia, sentimentality, romance, patriotism, humor, irony, and such, all best avoided. A safe poem would be a sort of still life, perhaps a couple of apples in a bowl, a few daisies in a vase, a wooden table, afternoon light. You get the idea. Transmigration. Once, at Christmas time, on an outing in the mountains, a mule deer gracefully and efficiently leapt over a fence and crossed the road in front of us. On the other side, he did likewise and cleared the high fence with ease. My son, 4, mind as yet uncluttered, said, "When I was a deer, I used to jump like that." Big time. The glaciers came and went, came again and retreated, repeating this elementary rise and fall over the eons, exposing the piece of granite on which I sit. They are gone now. And by now, I mean that briefest of time twinkles which contains everyone I know. Everything green around me belongs to now. The chipmunk hurries past in the now. The fish cruise by now. The sky, with its infinitely variable clouds, is on the glacier's side of time. The eagle and the fish you just plucked from the lake is on my time. The gull, who hassles the raptor, cheeky as he is, our side. The sun, big time. The sun flashes a glint off my brother-in-law's boat, which is a mile away and is in small time. The lake cannot fit this dichotomy, for like the clouds in the sky, it is filled, for like the clouds in the sky, it is fluid, with its water coming and going, even while I write this sentence. The loon that I watch fishing in front of me seems to be on my list of contemporaries until it calls. And then a portal opens to another timeless dimension as its laugh tremolos in a haunting rendition of insanity and divinity, which bridges the gap between my time and God's. Night shift. As the final moments of my last night shift slide from the future to the past, I want to assure the night that I bear no animosity towards it. As this rosy dawn progresses, I sense that I will not view dark air with the same dread that has prejudiced me this last 25 years. Perhaps I will view the night as a home to secrets and romance, and not the broker of violence and fear that it has seemed to me. When I commute on the silver train of night, it will be to go to the museum of dark things, and not to labor in the mine where dark deeds have deposited their ore. And when I step onto the platform at Daybreak Station again, I will have my satchel full of dreams, and my hair at the angles at which my new night job has left it. I hope that I will stop before hailing the bright yellow taxi of day and say a prayer for the servants who empty the chamber pots of the night. Pessimist. I have a nice house It is light and spacious, welcoming and comfortable, durable and functional, except for one room, where it is dark and damp, drafty and depressing. A lone chair faces a stained, blank wall. The chair's seat is hard, and its legs creak. For reasons that I cannot explain, I spend an inordinate amount of time in that room. I included the next poem because I wrote it here at Holden during my two-day visit last February, when Susie and I came up to interview for the position. Wool. I sit with the aroma of wet wool, an old and evocative smell, damp, warm, close. I spent an hour in the rain, cold, gray, quiet. Like my English forefathers, I spent the day clad in the hair of sheep. Sheep, they reasoned, were experts at standing in the rain. I'm sitting here smelling and puzzling. The wool fabric is famous for shrinking, whereas no one expects smaller sheep after a shower. My particular vestments were grown by ruminants from a land where sheep outnumber people, and rain is as common as grass. It's new enough that its originator is probably still on the job, turning rain and grass into hair. So far, I don't seem any smaller for the dowsing. Uncharted. Whenever I step over that boundary that I feel without seeing, I know that I am on my own. The risks, the rewards, the regrets, the memories, they will be mine. I cannot blame the map maker, for he left off at the dark line, and I am now on the stark white paper that could be dangerous or could be my paradise. I cannot blame my teachers, for I have knowingly wandered off the playground and beyond the lessons on the syllabus. I cannot blame my mother, for she warned me not to do practically everything, most especially not to cross the street at the edge of the known world. When I am in terra incognito, when I am in the terra incognito of feelings, knowledge, love, or faith, I am the explorer that I always dreamed I would be. And of course, last, mortality. I've been working on this poem for about 50 years. Mind you, not continuously. In fact, I ignore it for long periods of time, and sometimes I just stare at the title. But I add a line now and then, from a tombstone on a lonely sage-covered hill in Nevada, or a page six story of genocide in East Timor. The arc of the poem crests over an alpine meadow, resplendent in June, and then dips into the mud of a November farm foreclosure. Sometimes I think I can see the end of the poem. Other times, the lines march single file to the horizon. I won't finish the poem, of course. How could I? Thank you very much.